Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
I'd like to begin with a personal story. My grandmother was the daughter of a woman who was the child of persons who were enslaved on Rose Hill Plantation in North Carolina. And as a consequence, my sister and I are the fourth generation removed from slavery. My grandmother also lived in a town in North Carolina called Wilson, which was a tobacco stapling center. And she lived in a town that was characterized by the classic pattern that's featured in many, many southern towns in the United States. There was a railroad track that ran between the black side of town and the white side of town. as an act of separation that was emblematic of the Jim Crow period in the United States. There was a point at which I wanted to go and see a movie. Happened to be a Disney movie, after all, an old Disney movie called Darby O'Gill and the Little People. But it was being shown at the White Theater in Wilson, North Carolina, and my parents refused to let me go because they said we would be compelled to sit in the balcony. And they viewed this as an indignity that they were not going to stomach. And so I wasn't able to go. I was very hurt because I really wanted to see this movie. But I also came to realize as I grew a bit older that this was an indignity that was relatively minor in a social context in which lynchings and white massacres had become quite routine. So I would like to emphasize that when we think about the case for reparations, we are thinking about a case that is not exclusively centered on the harms and injustices and atrocities associated with slavery itself, but we have to view slavery as a crucible that created a subsequent array of atrocities that are associated with white supremacy in the United States. And those atrocities include those that were the product of slavery itself, but also of nearly 100 years of legal segregation in the United States, accompanied by white mob violence at frequent intervals. And so we usually refer to that as the Jim Crow period, and I want to emphasize when people say there are no living victims of slavery, there certainly are a number of us who are living victims of the Jim Crow period. Of course, if the nation waits long enough to engage in an act of redemption and compensation, we won't be alive any longer. But a national act of procrastination is not a justification for avoiding paying the debt. And then, of course, in the aftermath of the period of legal segregation, the post-Civil Rights Act era, we have a set of circumstances in which there were ongoing atrocities, inclusive of mass incarceration, police executions of unarmed blacks, the persistence of discrimination in employment, housing, and credit markets, as well as something that I'm going to emphasize in the remainder of my comments, the immense racial wealth gap in the United States. Now, in our book, From Here to Equality, which is authored with Kirsten Mullen, who happens to be my spouse, in our book, we define reparations as a program of acknowledgement, redress, and closure for a grievous injustice. Acknowledgement constitutes a circumstance in which the culpable party acknowledges or recognizes that it has committed a vicious harm, and it also acknowledges or recognizes that it has benefited from the execution of this vicious harm. Redress is the act of restitution on the part of the culpable party. And here we're going to talk in a moment about the role of the wealth differential in the United States between blacks and whites as a critical component of a redress process for black American descendants of U.S. slavery. The final component is closure, which is a point at which the culpable party and the victimized community come to an agreement that the debt has been paid, and no further claim will be made unless there's a renewal of the atrocities that have taken place in the past or a new array of atrocities is forthcoming. So I want to focus next on the wealth differential. And the wealth differential is best captured by the magnitude of these types of differences in black and white wealth. Black Americans constitute approximately 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.6% of the nation's wealth. Collectively across the globe, there's approximately $300 trillion in wealth. $100 trillion, or about a third of that, is in the possession of American citizens. And 90% of that is in the possession of white Americans. So we have a situation in which black Americans constitute a much, much higher percentage of the U.S. population than they do in terms of their share in the nation's wealth. This translates into a circumstance in which the average black household has approximately $800,000 less in net worth than the average white household. Another way to think about this is the fact that there are three white billionaires, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, who are worth more than the collective 80% of black Americans who are at the lower end of the wealth distribution. But it's not just a matter of the billionaires' wealth that explains this gaping differential. For example, white Americans, 25% of white Americans, have a net worth in excess of $1 million, but it's only 4% of black Americans. And wealth is important in terms of being distinguished from income. Wealth is a stock concept. It's the difference between the value of what we own and what we owe, the net property of our value, the net value of our property. Income, in contrast, is a flow concept that's most closely associated with our earnings. And wealth is more significant than income in terms of providing us with economic security and opportunities to fully participate in the society. Wealthier households have the capacity to survive income losses that might be associated with unemployment or medical emergencies. Wealthier families can provide their children with high-quality education and debt-free education. Wealthier families can have access to high-amenity neighborhoods. They can also purchase legal counsel, valuable legal counsel, when confronted with the criminal justice system. Wealthier families can leave bequests to subsequent generations to ensure their economic security and well-being. So wealth is extremely significant, and the differentials that exist between blacks and whites are connected to sharp differences in economic opportunity and well-being. Indeed, it's very important to note that the major factor that dictates what an individual or a family's level of wealth is the transfer of resources across generations, which means in turn that wealth captures the cumulative intergenerational effects of white supremacy in the United States when we think about the black-white differentials. And so in From Here to Equality, we argue that the goal of a reparations program, a goal that is associated with the redress component of reparations, is to eliminate the racial wealth gap. And this would be done primarily through direct payments to eligible recipients, black American descendants of U.S. slavery. In the book, we identify two standards for eligibility. The first criteria is what we refer to as a lineage criteria. An eligible individual would have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And the second criterion is what we refer to as an identity criterion. And this is a criterion that says that an individual would have to show that for at least 12 years before the onset of a reparations program, the enactment of a reparations program, or the enactment of a study commission for a reparations program, whichever comes first, for at least 12 years before that, an individual would have to have shown that they self-identified as black, Negro, or African American. The culpable party for making the payment is the United States government. The magnitude of the payment must be sufficient to eliminate racial wealth differentials within the course of a decade. I'd like to add finally that the coronavirus epidemic only further dramatizes the case for reparations. We've observed excess mortality on the part of black Americans. We've observed a collapse in black businesses, in black employment opportunities, and we've observed a high degree of crisis in terms of opportunities for education as our instructional environment has shifted from the classroom into the home via the internet. So as a consequence, we argue that it's important to continue to commit to the case for reparations in the midst of the pandemic. It's always an urgent time to to adopt reparations. It has been an urgent time for 155 years since the end of American slavery, where no restitution has been provided. It's time for the nation to pay the debt. It's time for racial justice. And borrowing from Chloe Valdari, I'd like to say that we collectively must become enchanted with the goal of racial equality.
Thank you so much, Sandy, for all of that and for explaining your book a little bit and also talking to this moment. And I think in thinking about this moment, you know, obviously the subject of reparations is not a new one. It's something that we have been having conversations about for a very long time. And, you know, I think that when you think about what we're experiencing right now, both related to the pandemic and violence against the Black community, the conversation often does sort of look at reparations as a way forward. And I'd love to hear you just sort of explain why you feel this moment might be different from others in making progress towards this.
I think that there has been a shift in the terrain that became evident in 2019, even prior to the coronavirus pandemic and prior to the widespread recognition of the phenomenon of anti-Black police violence, which the Black community has been well aware of for a long, long time. Even prior to that, I think in 2019, there was a signal shift in the environment with respect to attention that's being given to reparations. I'm not sure how to explain why that was the case, but for the first time in my lifetime, we had serious and credible political figures who were contesting for the presidency of the United States actually uttering the term reparations and potentially talking about whether or not there would be the grounds for introducing some sort of study commission for reparations through congressional legislation. That had never happened before in my lifetime. And it seemed to me in 2019 that the nation was having the most animated conversation about reparations on the political stage that had ever taken place since the Reconstruction era in the United States. So I think that the more recent chain of events has produced greater momentum for serious consideration of this idea. I think people are no longer dismissing it out of hand. I think they're trying to think about what the consequences would be for our nation of adopting a reparations program for Black American descendants of slavery in terms of our moral future as well as our social future collectively.
And so the idea of reparations, of course, stems from this concept of 40 acres and a mule, right? That after the abolition of slavery, rather, free slaves would receive 40 acres and a mule, a promise that the government, of course, never made good on. And so I'd like to get into some of the details of the plan that you put forward in terms of thinking first about what the value really is of that 40 acres and a mule today. So in other terms, you know, how do you quantify the full debt that you believe is owed to descendants of American slaves in 2020?
So the moment of the failure to provide the 40 acres is really a critical epic in American history. You know, I think it shapes the basis for the immense racial wealth gap that we observe today. So if we start with the moment in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War where the formerly enslaved were promised 40-acre land allotments, the minimum estimate of what that amount of land should have constituted would have been about 40 million acres. What happened initially was about 40,000 of the formerly enslaved individuals were settled on 400,000 acres. Out of the allotment that General Sherman had specified in Special Orders Number 15, which came closer to 5.3 million acres, stretching from South Carolina to northern Florida. But only 400,000 acres were actually ever settled, and toward the end of 1865, Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor after Lincoln was murdered, Andrew Johnson reverses the policy of settlement of the formerly enslaved altogether and restores the land to the former slaveholders. Now, at the same time, The Homestead Acts were being activated in the United States, providing large tracts of land to white settlers in the western part of the United States on tracts of land that had been appropriated and seized from the Native American population. In fact, those allotments were 160-acre allotments, and we estimate today that anywhere from 45 million to 90 million Americans are beneficiaries of those allocations because of the intergenerational effects of wealth transfers. So this is the starting point. We could use the present value of the 40 million acres as an estimate, as a lower bound estimate of what the magnitude of a reparations bill should be. And in the work that we've done, this comes to approximately $4 to $6 trillion, depending upon which interest rate you use to compound to the present. But in the work that we do, we also argue that what's really critical is to address the gaping racial wealth gap, the black-white wealth differential. And to do that, it would require somewhere in the vicinity of $10 to $12 trillion at the low-end estimate of what would be required for erasure of that differential.
Wow, and from that $10 trillion, we're talking about individual payments, or payments rather to individuals. This is not about money being funneled into programs, but actual checks that individual descendants of American slaves would receive. Is that right?
Yes. So the idea here is that if you're going to eliminate the racial wealth differential, you have to do it by taking the precise step of providing direct payments to the individuals who are eligible. If you go the indirect route, you will have a dilution of the delivery of the resources to the individuals who deserve them or merit them. So for example, if you pursue some sort of neighborhood-based or community-based operation in a world in which gentrification is running rampant, it would be very difficult to ensure that the resources would go to the folks who are supposed to receive them. So yes, one of the central objectives of a reparations program is to provide direct payments to the eligible recipients. I'm certainly open-minded about the prospect of having other kinds of programmatic initiatives that could be pursued, for example, providing resources and funds to historically black colleges and universities might be a potential option of what could be done with a reparations fund. But for substantive and symbolic reasons, the preponderant use of the funds must be direct payments to eligible recipients. And let me add, when I talk about payments, I don't necessarily mean cash payments per se. The objective is to eliminate the racial wealth gap. So what you really want to do is to build assets for black Americans. And those assets could be built in the form of trust accounts or endowments, not necessarily in the form of outright cash payments. So there are a number of options in the way in which you could provide individual eligible recipients with the resources from a reparations project.
And I mean, I think one of the big questions for a lot of people is sort of where will we see find this money? Do you anticipate that it's on the weight of tax dollars? Is this something that is, you know, rerouted from other programs? Where do we get the money?
So I think that I start with a rejection of the scarcity principle that underlines the view that you have to take money from pot A to produce money for pot B. I think that our most recent experience with the overnight provision of approximately $2.5 trillion to try to cope in some way with the coronavirus crisis indicates that the federal government is not constrained by tax payments to proceed with making new expenditures. So from my perspective, the government can simply set up a program of reparations payments and create the resources or create the funds that would address the needed amounts. You could do it over a period of years to make the annual VIG not quite as high. You could do it over the course of a decade, for example. But there's no tax-based constraint or revenue-based constraint on the capacity of the federal government to make additional expenditures. The only substantive constraint is the potential for producing high rates of inflation. And so you would necessarily have to design a reparations project or any new expenditure program in such a way that you mitigated the inflation risk. But that's the only barrier. And so I don't see us having to cut off other programs or avoid other kinds of valuable initiatives for the purposes of financing a reparations project.
Matt, I want to get into some of the criticisms of not just your plan, but reparations in general. But first, let's take a question from the audience. So Paul Rucker asks, will reparations work if the current systems stay in place? Seems like payment of reparations, would quickly go back to the white community.
So there was a sketch on Dave Chappelle's show when it was still on the air in which reparations were given to black Americans and all the money flowed back to white American corporations because of there was no infrastructure of black businesses that folks could actually purchase products from. So one response to this question is the money wouldn't quickly go back to the white community if an important aspect of a reparations project was the development of black businesses or black enterprises. So that's one answer. The second answer is associated with the point that I made a moment ago, that there are multiple ways in which the payments could be made. And if the payments are made in the form of an endowment or a trust, or what we call in more technical language and economics, less liquid assets, it's kind of a clumsy term, but that's what we say. If the payments are made in that form, you wouldn't have the money flowing out to anyone in an instantaneous fashion. People would have to make more discrete decisions about how to use the funds and when to use the funds. And so you potentially could have resources being devoted by individual black Americans to infrastructure development within the black community where there would be an opportunity to actually purchase goods and services from other members of the black community. So I think, you know, it's a question of whether or not you have a black business infrastructure, and it's a question of whether or not the payments are made in such a way that they're not outright cash payments that flow immediately out of people's hands.
You know, one of the things that's really compelling for me in talking with you is that I know that you were at one point not supportive of the idea of reparations. And so I'm curious to hear what sort of made you skeptical and what changed your feelings.
So around 1989, an economist named Richard America approached me about writing the introduction to a volume that he had assembled, where he had requested a group of economists to construct estimates of the magnitude of a reparations program. And At the time, I told Richard, well, you know, I think reparations is something that's ethically sound, but I don't think it's ever going to happen. That this is something that's really in the vein of speculative fiction, and it's just not going to occur. So why are we going to invest time in trying to work on a reparations project or collect essays about how much it would actually cost? And Richard said to me, with great wisdom, I didn't realize the depth of the wisdom at that time, but he said, read the essays and write whatever you choose to write. But I want you specifically to write the introduction. So I proceeded to read the essays, and the more that I read, the more that I became convinced that not only was a reparations project for black American descendants of U.S. slavery something that was vital to do from a moral standpoint, but it was vital to do from a practical standpoint. and that even if the odds were extremely long of actually having a reparations program come into realization, that it was something that I was obligated to pursue. And so it was in the process of working on Richard's book, which was later called The Wealth of Races, that I came to the point where I began to say that I had to do research and I had to do advocacy work in favor of reparations.
So, I mean, and let's talk a little bit, I think, about some of the criticisms that people do have of reparations. You know, I think first, one of the big ones you hear is if this is a way to sort of close the wealth gap, you know, is it really fair that, you know, descendants of slaves who have earned themselves into 1% would also be eligible to receive these checks? And how do you respond to those who say that?
Could you clarify, Whitney, what you mean by 1%? I'm not sure that I understand.
Yeah, I mean, so basically just if you're thinking about the Oprah Winfrey's of the world, the, you know, descendants of slaves who are, you know, millionaires and billionaires, and, you know, how can you justify payments for those people?
So a reparations project is not an anti-poverty program. It's an act of justice, restitution that has never been paid before. And so there is no criteria associated with the conditions of living eligible recipients that should block them from access. Now, if individuals like an Oprah Winfrey said, I'm so wealthy, this payment really is not of importance to me, I'd rather it go to somebody else, that's their discretion. But they certainly are eligible to receive it. When reparations payments were made to victims of the Holocaust by the German government, there was no inquiry about the economic status of the eligible recipients. When reparations payments were made to Japanese Americans in the United States to compensate to some degree for their unjust incarceration during World War II, no one asked how much is that particular individual earning or how much are they worth before they were given their $20,000 payment. So I think the same is true here. This is not a matter of how well individual black people are doing today. This is a matter of the collective difference in black wealth and white wealth, and that's what has to be spanned. And any black American who is a descendant of persons who were enslaved in the United States is eligible to receive it. It should be a matter of their discretion as to whether or not they take it.
And then for those who also think, you know, this money maybe would be better served if it were funneled into social service programs, you know, if you're thinking about money that might support failing education systems, or think about money that might support police reform and other ways that sort of prevent black Americans from attaining and maintaining wealth. What are your feelings about that?
So none of those approaches that I've seen, particularly kind of social programs in some grand sense, universal programs of redistribution, none of the ones that I've ever seen would meet the task of eliminating the black-white wealth differential in the United States. None of them have the capacity or the wherewithal to erase the black-white differential in wealth. And so they're simply not sufficient. They're not enough. And I'm particularly taken by the emphasis a lot of people want to place on providing resources for education. And as a university professor, of course, I'm fairly passionate about educational attainment. I'd be a hypocrite if I wasn't. But in terms of thinking about the racial wealth gap, educational attainment doesn't hold much promise at all. And see, here's a notorious statistic that I think is very telling on this score. Black heads of households with a college degree have two-thirds of the net worth of white heads of households who never finished high school. So you're not going to eliminate the racial wealth gap simply by giving black people more and better education, because you're not going to interrupt the intergenerational transmission effects that are associated with moving resources from one generation to the next, if you continue to have a community that doesn't have any resources to transfer to subsequent generations.
And let's take another question from the audience. So Anna asks, I'm concerned about proving eligibility, not because of the challenges of being able to track down genealogy records, but also because of the exclusion of members of the African diaspora who have lived in the United States. Can you speak more on this issue?
Yes. So first of all, there's no question that the types of criteria that I've talked about for eligibility will give genealogists a huge amount of business. But one thing that we propose in the final chapter of From Here to Equality, which is the chapter where we detail a program of reparations, is that the federal government, in the process of establishing the reparations project, could provide resources to individuals who are trying to establish their legitimate claims for reparations, resources for the genealogical research. There could be an agency that could be established that would do the genealogical research on behalf of individual claimants. And so I don't think that that's an impossibility. The other issue that's raised by the question here is are the contours of who would be included and who is excluded from this particular type of reparations project. And yes, the individuals who are more recent black immigrants to the United States, particularly after the 1960s, which is the vast majority of recent black immigrants to the United States, they would not be eligible for this program. And they would not be eligible because the anchor for this program is the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the 40 acres that they merited at the end of the period of enslavement. And this failure is what has had long repercussions for living black American descendants of U.S. slavery. Individuals who are more recent immigrants from other African countries don't share that particular historical effect or historical moment. And I think that that's what defines the unique position of this particular claim. If folks believe that more recent black immigrants do have some form of reparations claim, then I encourage them to try to develop it. But it's not the same one that's based upon the cumulative effects of slavery, Jim Crow, and ongoing white atrocities in the United States.
And you've been doing this work for a long time, and I think as we're running out of time here, I'm just curious about your sentiments about how you feel in terms of the progress that is being made towards this, and how far away or close do you feel we are to seeing a plan like yours realized or any sort of restitution realized for descendants of American slaves?
So like most economists, I'm horrendous at forecasting, and so I'm not entirely sure what's going to evolve. I will say this, the momentum that exists in the present moment is promising. And I would say that, in the year 2000, when Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff did a major survey, they found that only 4% of white Americans were in favor of reparations for black Americans. That figure is closer to about 20% now, and almost half of all millennials are in favor of reparations. So the direction seems to be going in the proper way. And I think that there is a significant amount of support, at minimum, for the creation of a commission to study reparations. The prelude to the Japanese American reparations was a commission called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. And there should be a parallel commission as a prelude to black American reparations. And the possibility of doing that is embodied in a piece of legislation called House Resolution 40. I will say that there are some serious limitations and weaknesses in the existing legislation as currently constructed. And I think that before we go forward with passage of that legislation, which seems to be quite possible, we need to actually revise its content. But apart from that, I think that that would be a key step in moving in the direction of a comprehensive reparations program for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
So I would love to introduce Brandon Holmes, who we are really excited to have here moderating in our panel, and also very excited to have as our incoming director for the Hudson Valley Regional Office of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Brandon is a leader in grassroots campaigns to end mass incarceration, driven by the ways he has seen incarceration affect his own family. Most notably, Brandon has experience in organizing and developing formerly incarcerated leaders throughout New York State. He was the organizer who led the passage of the New York City Fair Chance Act, which seeks to eliminate employment discrimination for justice-involved New Yorkers, and he recently managed the Close Rikers campaign, securing a bold commitment through a strategic plan to demolish all 14 of New York City's current jails by the year 2027 and replace them with four smaller, more humane detention facilities, prioritizing access to care and improving the conditions of confinement for incarcerated residents. Previously, Brandon served as an organizer for the New York Civil Liberties Union and is planning his return to the NYCLU as the incoming Hudson Valley Regional Director. Welcome, Brandon. Welcome to all of our panelists. Welcome to all of our attendees. We're really excited to have you. So take it from here, Brandon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And welcome, everybody. Good evening. We have a great panel today, so I'm going to get right into introducing everybody. And we want this to be a conversation between the experts in this issue area, and also be able to give you all something to walk away with, something to know what your next steps can be to take action or to educate yourselves more on the issues surrounding reparations. So first, I want to introduce Jennifer Bellamy, the Senior Legislative Counsel at the ACLU's National Political Advocacy Department. Jennifer joined the ACLU in 2008 and serves as a senior legislative counsel in the organization's NPAD department, where she advocates on a range of racial justice issues. Jennifer has played a leadership role in the passage of the Fair Sentencing of 2010, which reduced the infamous and discriminatory sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine and began to address some of the serious racial disparities plaguing the criminal justice system. Thank you, Jennifer, for that work. Then I want to introduce Trevor Smith. Trevor is also a NYCLU alum and is a narrative and cultural strategist who writes and researches on topics such as racial inequity, the wealth gap, and reparations. Trevor is currently the director of narrative change at Liberation Ventures, where he is building the first narrative lab that is dedicated to building narrative power behind reparations. Trevor has previously worked in the program and communication roles at the Cerdna Foundation, ACLU, and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you, Trevor, for your amazing work and the legacy you've left around this issue. And next, I want to introduce Congressman Jamal Bowman, who represents New York's 16th District. Congressman Bowman's district includes the Northern Bronx and parts of Westchester County, including his home of Yonkers. He was elected to Congress in 2020, and Jamal Bowman ran on a platform of transformative, progressive policies that will no doubt improve the lives of those who have been legislated out of the American dream. Congressman Bowman is dedicated to passing visionary policy that infuses climate justice with economic and racial justice, and to highlighting the importance of research and investing in communities of color on the ground. Thank you very much, Congressman Bowman. So with the three panelists, this first question to start our conversation, I want to set the stage for all of you. So if you'll indulge me, please close your eyes. And I want you to envision this, right? It is the perfect world. And you wake up and you and whoever you trust most in this work are now co-directors of the United States Department of Reparations. I'm going to ask each of you in order to name one single issue or discipline area when you would start to invest in immediate reparations. So first I want to go to Jennifer, then we'll go to Trevor, and then Representative Bowman. So Jennifer, one single issue or discipline area that you would invest in immediate reparations.
Well, thank you so much, Brandon, for that question and for that introduction. This is a very thoughtful way to begin our discussion. And with this question, which is very, it's really sort of a, you know, foundational question, I would say if I had the power to make that decision, I would invest my decision-making power in creating a commission because I want all of it, and I want to be able to address the range of issues and look at the ways that we have been impacted by institutional racism and by the practices that were enshrined in law in this country over decades. And so I think in order to fully do this justice, I like the commission approach that is outlined in H.R. 40, and I know we'll have an opportunity to talk about it more later, because it is holistic, because it does not limit us, and we are able to not only bring the ideas that we have, and I'm sure the other panelists will have excellent ideas to share. In addition to, you know, any idea that I could think of, there will be others who will have the opportunity to share ideas, and also we'll get to hear from people who are impacted in their communities as well. So it really lays out a very comprehensive process similar to the one that we saw Japanese Americans successfully undertake in their fight for reparations.
Thanks. Trevor, you're up.
Thanks for that, Jennifer. And yeah, Brandon, this is a very hard question. It's kind of like asking a parent to pick their favorite child. It's really hard. So I'm going to kind of follow Jennifer's lead, and really, I can't just pick a single thing, because that's the thing about reparations. It can't be looked at as a single pronged issue, because harm was caused in multiple ways. So at Liberation Ventures, we're building out this framework that's based on a variety of concepts from the UN Human Rights, Movement for Black Lives, National African American Reparations Commission, and COBRA, and Dr. Darity and Kirsten Mullen's work. And thinking about this holistically, and we're calling it a repair framework. And so it includes redress, which can and should include compensation, but then it also includes reckoning, and we talk about accountability and acknowledgement. And we think those four components are what makes a comprehensive reparations program. So in addition to financial compensation, which I think should come in directly in the form of cash, but could also look like student loan forgiveness or business grants, we need a reckoning in this country. I think as we all know, and we all seen this kind of anti-history, critical race theory fight, we need to also change the curriculum and shift public conversations. We need a real truth and reconciliation process, which I know Representative Bowman has advocated for. And ultimately, we need to change our culture because, as I said, it needs to be a constant process to build this culture of repair. And then acknowledgement. You know, I think harm has been caused, as I said, in multiple spaces. And so I think an apology is needed not only at the federal level, but also at the local, state, and in the private sector. And so I'm sorry, I can't answer it directly how you ask, but I hope that kind of gives you a sense of how reparations should be thought about.
Great. Congressman?
Okay, I'm not going to cheat. My two fellow panelists, they both cheated. Even though I agree with everything they said, I'm going to try to answer the question. You know, it's interesting. As I was closing my eyes, what came to mind for me was housing. I don't know why, but that came to mind first. And I guess I'm thinking about reversing the impact of redlining on our community. So I'm thinking about housing and community development and thinking about the security of housing, of adequate housing, the safety of adequate housing, and how adequate housing can provide the space for freedom of thought, the space for creativity, the space to build the world that we are trying to build for the African American community. I just thought about housing. Housing came to mind for me, you know, thinking about how, you know, public housing has been neglected. again, redlining and the New Deal and how that created or contributed to the separate and unequal America that we have, wealth inequality related to housing. That's what came to mind for me. But I agree with Jennifer and Trevor. They are absolutely right. That would be the first thing, but it's not going to be the only thing because obviously there's so much more to repair based on historical harm.
Thank you. Thank you, each of you, for your perspectives and definitely pushing back to challenge that it must be comprehensive. Anything we talk about has to be a comprehensive plan. So that leads us to just talking about how there has been many ways that the U.S. has either attempted or successfully issued reparations in the past, right? And then there's many ways that we can be demanding that the U.S. government do so now, whether that's in the form of direct checks to the descendants of enslaved people, or if that's housing vouchers and grants that would be made available specifically for people who are impacted by the justice system. I want to ask first, Trevor, who should be at the forefront of negotiating what a comprehensive reparations plan should look like? And can you talk a little bit about why those are the communities involved?
Yeah, so thanks for that question. I think as with most issues, the people closest to the issue, those directly impacted, specifically when it comes to reparations, because reparations is about addressing past harm done onto communities, specific communities, those are the folks that must be leading it. What's important, though, I think, is that it's as inclusive of Black Americans as possible, right? So because racial injustice in this country, as it relates to Black people, it's impacted millions of people. So only the federal government has the capital and the convening power to get the various entities needed in a room to craft a comprehensive reparations policy. And so that's exactly what H.R. 40 seeks to do. By creating this commission, it seeks to empower whoever might serve on that commission to ensure that the voices of Black Americans are represented in this comprehensive policy.
Thanks, Trevor. And I want to go to Jennifer next. Jennifer, could you share some examples around reparations or past examples of reparations that we can learn from today?
I'm so glad you asked me that question, Brandon. And I just also want to add a little bit, if I can, to Trevor's answer before about having people at the table. I think one of the things that is going to be very beneficial from the H.R. 40 process is providing that opportunity for impacted people to lead the way in the work, but also providing an opportunity for impacted voices to be heard. One of the things that we learned from our friends in the Japanese American community that was very healing and therapeutic was just having the opportunity to tell the truth about what happened to them during the internment of Japanese Americans for which they received reparations from the federal government. A part of that process, in addition to creating a commission very similar to the commission that the commission in H.R. 40 is modeled after, and just in case folks are not aware of it, H.R. 40 is a bill that is in Congress that would establish a commission that would examine the institution of slavery and its legacy and make recommendations for reparations to Congress. And it's modeled after a bill that was developed during the Japanese-American fight for reparatory justice, which they ultimately succeeded in receiving reparations for the incarceration of Japanese-Americans during World War II. And one of the things that we learned from our friends in the Japanese American community was the opportunity to be heard at hearings that were held around the country during this commission process was very therapeutic, just having an opportunity for folks to make their voices heard. So I just wanted to add that when we talk about the comprehensive opportunity that people will have to be a part of this H.R. 40 process. The other piece that I'll say, which is a largely unknown fact, is that this country does have a history of paying reparations. In 1860, America had about 4 million enslaved people, and there were, as a result of it, there were a number of millionaires in the United States, and that wealth was directly from the enslavement of others. But what people may not know is that in 1862, before President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he paid reparations to enslavers of people. He paid $300 for each enslaved person that was freed. And so the country has paid reparations. You know, people may say, oh, it's too hard, it's impossible, we've never done it before. But if we look in the history of the United States, we have done it. And you know, and this is just justice. This is about justice delayed doesn't necessarily have to be justice denied. And the total that the Lincoln administration paid was about $1 million to the people who had enslaved people, and that was just for those folks who were living in D.C. So I just wanted to flag that you know, fact that might not be known to everyone, but I think it is very important in this conversation as we're talking about reparations.
Thank you. Yeah, to know that there's such an old history of the country acknowledging that harm and actively doing something gives me a little bit of hope to think that H.R. 40 could be the next iteration of that. This could be something that this generation is able to reflect on and say, like, we didn't let that legacy die. So I want to pass to Representative Bowman. Could you talk to us about the status of the H.R. 40 Commission, and what can you tell us about maybe advancing or elevating the work that the commission is about to take on?
Absolutely. I just want to go back to something Jennifer just said, just to make sure I heard her clearly. Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln, paid reparations to the slave masters who lost their slaves in Washington, D.C. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. That is what I'm saying.
Got it. So we paid the slave master for
I didn't even catch that, I have to say. Yes. Oh, my God.
For their losses, but we haven't provided recompense to the formerly enslaved and their ascendants. Wow, that's powerful. Thank you for sharing that. And just one brief comment on, you know, who's at the table, right? So, first of all, there have been people who have been researching this issue for several decades, so we definitely want them to be a part of the conversation. Obviously, people who have been most impacted by the legacy of slavery need to be a part of the conversation as well, and congressional hearings as well as hearings across the country can be a part of that. But with 21st century technology, there's a way to crowdsource and make sure we get as much feedback and input from as many people across the country as possible. So I think that's going to be key, just to, because that large conversation is going to help with the healing process as well, because everyone will have an opportunity to have their voices be heard. And recent research has identified the epigenetic intergenerational impact of slavery on African Americans today. So we're not just talking about the fact on de jure, we're talking about how genetically is passed down through transgenerational epigenetics. So that's recent research. I'm still reading it, still going through it, but it's another data point to show the need for a study, the need for a commission to study the impact is needed. Right now, H.R. 40 is moving through the House of Representatives. So for the last 30 years, it's been introduced, but it's never been marked up in committee and voted out of committee. This is the first year it's ever been voted out of committee. So that's a really, really big deal. It has over 200 co-sponsors, and you need 218 votes for it to pass the House. Today we had a press conference, and I'm in communication right now with Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, who is the lead sponsor for this bill, and we are working to work with the leadership of the House to bring it to the floor for a vote. Now, what's key here is it's not just about Congresswoman Jackson Lee's voice and leadership or my voice and leadership. We need everyone out in the community that supports H.R. 40 being brought to the floor for a vote to engage House leadership and push them to bring it to the floor for a vote. That is constant phone calls. That is constant letters. That is constant emails. That is going on social media. That is going on any media that's out there to continue to apply that pressure. We are about to ratchet up the pressure. Hopefully, we'll pass the Build Back Better Act this week, and then push to pass our budget. push the Senate on voting rights, but in terms of the House, the next big fight in the House, it has to be H.R. 40. Immigration reform has already passed the House, sitting in the Senate. Common sense gun reform passed the House, it's in the Senate. Voting rights passed the House, it's in the Senate. H.R. 40 is the next big fight, and we need everyone to engage with their local reps, but also leadership. Speaker Pelosi, Leader Hoyer, Whip Clyburn, and Chair Jeffries. We need to put a lot of pressure so that it could be brought to the floor for a vote.
Thank you. I want to share a little bit about a poll that was taken in 2020. It's shown that 31% of people support the idea of reparations, which is an increase from 19% when a poll was taken in 1999. So over 21 years, we saw a 12% increase in support for reparations. However, we still have 63% of Americans saying they oppose the idea of reparations, and the racial disparities there are very clear, right? With over 8 in 10 Black Americans supporting reparations, and over 75% of white Americans saying they oppose reparations. So Trevor, because you're doing a lot of narrative work and you're preparing for a listening tour around reparations, could you talk a little bit about what you think may contribute to the rise in support for reparations, and what kind of narrative shifts or moments do we need to bring it more to the forefront, to make it more popular?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm really glad you asked this question because, as you said, it's something that I've been focused on a lot right now. So in terms of the increase of support, I think there's obviously, as you know, Brandon, a lot of behind the scenes things. You know, organizers on the ground have been pushing this issue forward for years. There's legacy organizations, some of which who I named at the top, NARC and COBRA, who have been advocating for this issue for years. So there's, you know, advocacy organizing work that's been going on for centuries, really. You know, I first came into this work through research, learning about Queen Mother Audley Moore. And so we're really standing on the shoulders of our ancestors. And so, as you know, nothing gets done just by magic. So it's a lot of the organizers. But then there's also some really tangible things. The case for reparations, I think, by Ta-Nehisi Coates, written in The Atlantic a couple years ago, is a piece that brought a lot of folks who were not familiar with the topic at all into the subject, right? And so he obviously is just a brilliant writer. And so that's a piece that I still reference today, and people who are still new to the topic reference today. And I urge folks who might not have read it to just Google the case for reparations. It's the first thing that'll come up. And then more recently, the 1619 Project, right? And so I was trained as a journalist. I have a comms background. And so those two pieces, I think, are some of the most powerful pieces that have really increased public awareness and really reframed how the story that we tell about America. And it's a reframing it from a story of an exceptionalism to one of theft. And so those two pieces, I think, have really increased support. And so then in terms of the polling, at LV, we're doing some polling and we're having conversations, and we're seeing support increase when you frame reparations related to kind of more recent wrongdoing. So things like police brutality, folks can kind of grasp onto, which I think makes sense. You know, I think non-Black people today can see and even themselves experience bad interactions with the police. And so our polling shows that when you frame reparations within kind of the more recent injustices in the criminal justice context, support goes up. And then we're also seeing support go up when you frame it as financial compensation in addition to things like housing and housing grants and education investments. So I say all that to say that, you know, polling is important. We're going to be doing some more intentional comms work with this polling, but I really think, and I really focus on the narratives and narrative change. And I think about narratives as kind of the averages of our most popular stories, right? And so what are the most popular stories that we've told about race in America? They've all been anti-Black. They're rooted in anti-Blackness. The first form of popular entertainment in this country, the minstrel shows, are rooted in anti-Blackness. And then a lot of those tropes and stereotypes persist today. So anti-Blackness is a meta-narrative that we're kind of grappling with, and then there's kind of sub-narratives underneath that. The racial progress narrative is one that often, you know, crops up. Mitch McConnell, when he got asked about reparations, he said, we don't need things like reparations because we elected a Black president in Barack Obama. And so this idea that we are inching closer to this post-racial country, you know, is a falsehood. And then it really makes people overly optimistic and overestimate the state of racial and economic inequality. And we also have the meritocracy narrative. That's one we're up against. And then one I think, you know, doesn't get a lot, much attention is this, the lost cause narrative. You know, the idea around the Confederacy and the stories we tell about the Confederacy. I had the pleasure to see Ta-Nehisi Coates and Nicole Hannah-Jones last night in Brooklyn for the release of her new book, The 1619 Project. And she talked about how we don't view the Confederacy in the same light of how we view Nazis and Nazism. We would, you know, Germany would never have a monument of Hitler, but we have monuments and schools named after Robert E. Lee, even though, you know, they tried to tear this country apart to ensure that the institution of slavery would stick around. So these are the narratives I think that we're up against, and we have to be really intentional about creating a strong narrative infrastructure like those on the right have, as we've seen with this critical race theory fight, to really push back on it.
Thank you, Trevor. And, you know, that kind of leads me into one thing you said there, right, that there's this post-racial narrative, right, that we're beyond this. We've elected a black president before, and, hey, he even got a second term, right? But in the debate about reparations, another thing that comes up with that is people talking about slavery and saying that, you know, slavery is ended, kind of talking about it as if it's a thing of the past. But we know, thanks to a lot of media and narrative work done around the 13th Amendment, that the 13th Amendment still protects the right to treat incarcerated people as slaves. So I want to actually ask both Jennifer and Representative Bowman if you could respond to this question. In our fight to push for reparations, how do we include those who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated despite the harm they may have caused, or all of the reasons that people will tell us, like, reparations are for good black people, or reparations are for this group of people, not that group of people? How do we challenge those narratives? And maybe even if you have any experience in having those conversations, tell us, you know, what have you gone through? So we can start with Jennifer.
Okay, I'm glad you asked that question, because, you know, one of the legacies of slavery is the disproportionate incarceration of African American people. You know, as a society, we have chosen to invest more into incarceration than we've invested in communities, in building communities. And we've also invested more in the types of things that result in over-incarceration and mass incarceration than we've invested in interventions. And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned before is this idea, you know, that, you know, enslavement of people happened long ago, and, you know, so we shouldn't really focus on it. But I think what that conversation overlooks is the legacy of slavery. We had redlining that was very prevalent for a long time. We had lynching. We had various forms of discrimination and exclusion from employment opportunities, from lending and banking opportunities, you know, from opportunities for farmers. I mean, there were so many opportunities that the federal government alone provided that African American people were categorically excluded from just because of being African American. But then also, while they were excluded from opportunity, they were disproportionately, you know, given this pathway to mass incarceration. And frequently, you know, as we will see if we're looking in at the statistics, frequently for very similar types of things, but the penalties are harsher and people and the effects are longer lasting. And so the benefit of H.R. 40 is that the commission will look at all of it. And absolutely, we have to have everyone at the table and hear all of those stories. But I think the benefit of the commission is that would it examine all of these different areas and make recommendations that will address all of the ways that the legacy of slavery has impacted African-American people in this country.
Every descendant or ascendant of slaves will benefit from the study for the need for reparations and reparations themselves, every single one. Jennifer is absolutely right. Mass incarceration is a part, sort of the evolution of the continued oppression of Black people in this country. You know, we escaped the South, the Jim Crow South. We escaped the Ku Klux Klan, or attempted to, and we came north and to the Midwest, and we found redlining and a lack of jobs and police that were a part of a system of mass incarceration. This is about repair, and this is about healing, and our brothers and sisters and non-binary people who are incarcerated need healing as much as everyone else. So not just a part of the table, at the table and a part of the conversation, but definitely will benefit from reparations and the study of reparations. So absolutely, it's this country, it's repairing the harm caused by the country's original sin that didn't end with the ending of slavery. Slavery, Jim Crow, the Klan, redlining, crack cocaine, mass incarceration, police brutality, intergenerational epigenetics, it's all part of it, right? So that's what we're healing, and we need all voices and all narratives and all stories and all reality to be a part of that.
Thank you. Thanks, both of you. So I want to pause here. We are going to start moving towards our Q&A portion. So if anybody has a question, you can put that into the chat. Or there's a Q&A function if you see down at the bottom of your screens. You can use the Zoom Q&A function. We'll start to pull some questions from there. But first, a closing question for each of our panelists. I want to ask, for people who want to increase their education or begin taking immediate action to support the fight for reparations, what would you recommend? Let's start with Trevor.
So when thinking about using your voice, particularly if you're a non-Black person, think about where you hold places of power and try to advance those conversations, advance conversations around reparations and reparative justice in those spaces. In terms of using your time, you know, I know we're all busy, but you know, these orgs that are working on reparations advocacy day to day, the folks on the ground doing the organizing work, they're underfunded. And so thinking about what skill sets you might have and how it might be beneficial. You know, there's a white ally group who I held a fundraiser for last year called the Fund for Reparations Now. And in a similar way to Surge, they convene and organize white people. And so I think if you're a white person interested in getting involved in this issue, I would look them up either on Instagram. They have a Twitter. They also have a website, and they fall under NARC. And then obviously use your dollars. I think obviously the bulk of funding has to come from philanthropy or high net worth individuals. And then again, the government has to pass HR 40 so that we can really see the change that we seek. But in order for that to happen, the organizers have to organize, the researchers have to research, the communications people have to do the communications work. And so think about how you could pool your funds with colleagues and move it to places at the local level. There's organizations like the Beloved Community Center, Media 2070, which I know Representative Bowman actually has partnered with before, the Truth Telling Project. If you're interested in how young people are advocating around this issue, look into the Amendment Project. So there's a host of organizations doing the work that need your dollars. And so those are the things I'd say.
Good, thank you. Jennifer.
Well, I really appreciated Trevor's very comprehensive list. That was very thorough, and I really, just echo his comment. All of his websites and resources that he identified, I think, are particularly helpful in becoming educated on the issue. And I will also just lift up that on the ACLU's website, there is an action alert that people can go to, and when they get to that action alert, they can send a letter to their member of Congress and ask their Congress member to co-sponsor HR 40. And if they're already a co-sponsor, they can ask their member of Congress to urge that this be brought to the floor for a vote. So I will lift that up as an additional resource as well.
Thank you. And Representative Bowman?
Please contact my office. Just contact my office. Call my office. Email my office. We're going to be organizing people around this issue so that we can move Congress leadership in the House in the direction it needs to go. So do everything that Trevor and Jennifer said, absolutely do those things, but also contact my office and we'll help everyone get organized around how we're going to put pressure on leadership and other members in the House to make sure this gets moving, because we are so close. We are closer than we have ever been in passing H.R. 40. And if we pass H.R. 40 in the House, there have been some whispers that it doesn't even have to pass the Senate, that will be enough for the president to sign an executive order and form the commission with the House's passage. So it's really key for us to continue to apply pressure in the House to make sure the leadership moves it. And I'm talking leadership. Again, Speaker Pelosi, Leader Hoyer, and others. But contact our office, and we'll help you get moving in terms of applying that pressure.
Great. Well, thank you all. And folks, don't go anywhere. We still have about 15 minutes left to ask them some questions. We do have two questions in the chamber right now. I'm going to start with one. And anybody who feels equipped to answer this, please come off mute and go right ahead. Shouldn't people who cannot demonstrate an enslaved ancestor but who have suffered from racist discrimination be included in reparations? Does anyone want to take that question?
I can respond to that. I think one of the benefits of H.R. 40 is that it establishes a commission that will examine the institution of slavery and its legacy and then make recommendations to Congress. And so instead of trying to address the big issues like the one that you raised at the outset, you know, we are establishing this commission process so that everyone has an opportunity to be heard. And as a part of this process, those types of issues can be looked at and those types of determinations can be discussed and made. And so I think, you know, you're raising exactly the types of things that we need to be thinking about. And then we also have a process that is set up as we move forward.
Thank you. And before our next question, I want to just flag something in case some folks aren't watching the chat. Some folks from NCOBRA have shared that they've identified five ways that folks still suffer, which are nationhood or peoplehood, education, health, wealth, as well as criminal punishment. So if you're looking for a framework to start having these conversations at home, there's another resource that you can look into shared by NCOBRA. Our next question, someone asked, given the importance of H.R. 20 and its tie to civil rights, why wasn't it a part of the civil rights legislation? Does anyone understand the prompt?
I may have just gotten here. Do they mean H.R. 40 when they say H.R. 20? I mean, what is H.R.?
Yeah, it does say H.R. 20, but I believe it may mean H.R. 40, yes. So why was it not a part of civil rights legislation is the question.
Well, it's interesting. When I first got here and started having conversations about H.R. 40, you know, the response from leadership and others was, you know, something to the effect of the country isn't ready for it. The country wasn't ready to have the reparations conversation. You know, civil rights is obviously an important conversation. We passed the Civil Rights Act, I believe, in 1965. It's something that, you know, everyone can wrap their minds around. Yes, we all deserve civil rights. We all deserve human rights. But when you start talking about reparations in a country that's still majority not black, people start thinking that, you know, in terms of the narrative piece, you're taking money or something from them and giving it to blacks for something that they didn't do, right? They, you know, we didn't own slaves. You know, I'm not a part of that, right? So what I was told when I first got here is the country wasn't ready for that, even after George Floyd. So the work that Trevor's doing is so important because it is about narrative and it is about storytelling. It is around engaging in conversations because we have to shift paradigms in terms of what we're talking about and what we actually mean and how it heals the entire country and benefits the entire country. Those are two major parts of the narrative that we have to move towards and move towards now, not just not allow it to be kicked down the road again, which is going to happen if everybody on this call doesn't apply pressure on leadership right now. It'll be something that we will not tackle during this Congress.
I guess to piggyback on that, I want to ask any of you who want to jump in, right, one of the biggest arguments against reparations is the cost of implementation. When we have a plan, it's going to cost money, and that makes people upset. But since the COVID-19 pandemic began, we've seen U.S. billionaires increase their wealth by 62% or $1.8 trillion richer. And this has also allowed wealthier individuals to thrive and just devastated small business owners and working class families, and predominantly Black Americans were and continue to be disproportionately affected by the financial burdens of the pandemic. So what would you say to somebody who thinks that providing reparations right now just doesn't make sense or is unrealistic because of the, quote, economy?
So I would just like to share, you know, I think as most folks are aware, in June, with unanimous support in the Senate and, you know, overwhelming support in the House, a bill establishing a Juneteenth National Independence Day was quickly voted out of Congress, and it was passed into law, signed into law by the president. And that bill, which provided a federal holiday, while it's important, it was a very expensive bill. And, you know, while those types of symbolic measures are important, what we need is reparatory justice. We need H.R. 40. And so if we're just looking at cost, you know, there's already been demonstrated willingness to spend money on a Juneteenth national holiday. But here we're asking, you know, our Congress and our leadership to move beyond the symbolic and provide reparatory justice and, you know, in the simple form of establishing a commission. And so I just want to hold that up as a just recent demonstration of how we have been willing to spend on this topic, but not gone far enough.
What I'd say is, you know, in the same year that Jennifer was talking about it, when Abraham Lincoln gave enslavers reparations, that same year the Homestead Act was signed, and it gave away millions of acres for free, most of which went to white people. So in fact, 1.5 million white people, both American-born and immigrant, profited from the Homestead Act. And I was doing research earlier today, and what floored me is that in the year 2000, so at the turn of the millennium, there was about 46 million people, which was a quarter of the U.S. population at the time, who were descendants of the original Homestead Act recipient. And so many white people can trace their economic stability and wealth to one policy, to one kind of large land wealth transfer. And so when it came to white people, we had no issue doing it. And then I think the other thing I would say is that, you know, our spending, you know, really signals what our values are. You know, immediately as we were coming out of Afghanistan, we saw, you know, figures that came out about how much we spent on a obviously needless war. And I think I saw a figure that we spent $5.8 trillion on all conflicts stemming from September 11th, 2001, up until today. And so $5.8 trillion is almost half of what a reparations package would cost, according to Dr. Darity and other academics. Who think that a reparations package that would close the racial wealth gap would be about 12 to 13 trillion. And so we find the money for other things, and we find the money for occupation, and we find the money for killing people. And so I think we could also find the money for things like this.
Yeah, we find the money for war. We find the money for white people, not just today, but historically. But when it comes to African Americans, we never find the money. The federal government is different than state and local governments. So state and local governments have to balance budgets, right? Like at a kitchen table, the way we all do with a checkbook, we have to balance budgets. We collect X amount of taxes, invest in public goods, pay salaries, pay pensions, and all of those things. The federal government is different. We are a sovereign nation. We have a fiat currency. Our money is not connected to gold any longer. So we can do something called or engage in something called deficit spending or investing in the economy at any level we choose. We just did it during the COVID pandemic to re-stimulate the economy, to rescue the economy. We did it in 2008 during the housing crisis when we bailed out big banks in the form of hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. Trump, in his first year of president, he gave $5 trillion tax breaks to the wealthiest among us. Again, we invest in what we prioritize. It's just historically we haven't prioritized black folk and we haven't prioritized repairing the harm of slavery and its legacy. You know, when you invest in historically marginalized people and communities, people then contribute more to the economy and it actually makes the economy stronger, which is something that's not talked about enough. And it'll increase GDP. And what also needs to happen is you tax the wealthy and large corporations equitably, and that helps control inflation and keeps it balanced. What we have now is we don't tax the wealthy and corporations equitably, so things remain out of balance because wealth remains concentrated in their hands. If you give everybody else wealth and don't adjust the tax code, then we'll have out of control inflation. So that's a BS argument, as someone put in the chat.
Thank you. I think we will have time for one more question or so. This is going to be a mix of a couple different questions we're getting, but I think you've all spoken directly to, like, how do we protect the narrative and the process of identifying what reparations should look like, what a comprehensive reparations package should look like. That's including folks who have researched this for decades. That's including people who are most impacted and people, you know, who are impacted in different areas, whether it be housing, whether it be mass incarceration. But are there any, I guess the question here that I'd want to toss out to kind of capture what people are putting in chat is, are there any, like, pitfalls or threats to co-opting this movement and this narrative that you all can foresee and kind of give us some, like, tools on how we can challenge that and, like, stay firm in our belief that directly impacted communities must be at the table talking about reparations and that we cannot allow this to be, you know, a thing that is, we're beyond that. We're beyond race. This is just going to cause more harm. How do we show that or, you know, tell that story? I hope that made sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I'd say is what I'm a little bit afraid of in terms of the co-optation is, you know, sort of what we heard from Mitch McConnell earlier when he got asked, you know, last year around the uprisings. You know, I don't want the government to, the federal government, for Congress to think that an increase in housing vouchers or increase in SNAP or things that we're already doing, you know, our reparations, you know, Representative Bowman talks about Medicare for All. He talks about federal jobs guarantee. Those things are needed in addition to reparations. And so what I don't want is folks, you know, saying, well, we're going to do UBI or we're going to do baby bonds or we're going to do a federal jobs guarantee. That's your reparations. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about both. We're talking about federal jobs guarantee and reparations. And so that's what I'm scared of. But when we have folks like Representative Bowman there, I'm confident that that's not going to happen. But it is a slight scare of mine. But I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, I would just add, I appreciate the kind words, brother, but I'm not enough. And what I mean by that is we need more people like me here, number one, and we have a good, nice group that I think many of you know very well, which is great. In addition to that, we need outside pressure as well, because I've watched special interest groups wield power in Congress like you wouldn't believe. Fossil fuel industry, pharmaceutical companies, and many other lobbies, Fraternal Order of Police. They'll call leadership and tell leadership to have a bill voted on the same day, and all of a sudden it'll be on our calendar and we'll vote on it same day. They'll call leadership and ask leadership to pull a bill will get pulled same day. So I've watched that kind of power be wielded, and Trevor's absolutely right. This conversation can be degraded into something like housing vouchers, which again are great and very helpful and absolutely needed, but that's one aspect of what we're talking about, and that's why we got to continue to push very aggressively the envelope of the commission, because you know everybody on this call already knows what the commission is going to find, but we want America to see, and we want to be very transparent so everyone, so it's undeniable that the need is there and what that need is ultimately going to be.
Yeah, I think the thing that, you know, I'm concerned about, and I guess I'm more optimistic than concerned, because I think in order to do advocacy, you have to be a bit of an optimist and a worker. And I think the thing that I would just like for us to continue to do is to keep working. I think anytime you're close to the finish line, especially if you've been, you know, advocating for something for a long time, it can be tempting to say, well, you know, we are not quite there yet, so let's just forget it. And that would just be such a tragedy. We're so close. I mean, we've made so much progress. We've made more progress in the last Congress than we had in the, you know, previous history of the bill. In the 114th Congress, I think there were two co-sponsors. As Congressman Bowman said, in this Congress, we have around 200 co-sponsors and adding daily. So this is absolutely the time to push. This is absolutely the time to continue to put that pressure where we need it on a political process, because that's what's needed in order to get things done on Capitol Hill. We don't, get close to the finish line and then walk away, you know, from what we have, but we keep pushing until we get the win that we want. And I think that's absolutely what we need here. And so that's the thing that, you know, I want to see is that because we are so close, I think we need to be more energized and more strategic and keep pushing until we get over the finish line.
Great. And I'm so glad that all three of you felt energized to respond to that question, because that will be the end of this amazing panel. I want to thank Jennifer Bellamy, Trevor Smith, and Representative Bowman for your time and expertise tonight, and all the resources that you were able to share with folks. And I also want to thank Lucia for pulling this event together. And I look forward to working with you all when I join the New York Civil Liberties Union in January. Everyone, have a good evening.
Peace and love, everyone.
For having us.
Everyone.
Good afternoon, San Francisco. How are you? I am so fired up to be here. I have been an absolute fan and sister to the city of San Francisco under the leadership of Dr. Cheryl Davis and the entire team since I met Dr. Davis. I guess it's been a couple years now, really. And I just want to, first of all, I love the theme of starting with gratitude. Start with gratitude for just even being in this space with you, being able to be in this space with you, and being partners with such a rich city in the work of racial redress, black empowerment, black liberation, and so on. So happy to be here. My name is Robin Ruth Simmons. I am the founder and executive director of First Repair. While a city councilwoman in Evanston, I led our city in passing the nation's first funded reparations initiative that is funded with tax revenue. And so I'm actually going to start, yes, thank you. Very, very proud of our city, but also committed to doing so much more, because as important as that step is, relative to the harm, it's insufficient. So the work continues. So I wanted to open a little bit differently than I usually do with a video. Since we have a short amount of time, I wanted to open with this two-minute trailer that shows snippets of the milestones and also the challenges of doing reparations work and how complex it is and also how historic it is. So I'm going to start with that video, and then we're going to get into the work. So let me make sure I have this right.
It should be cash payment.
I think what they're offering us is an insult.
How do you determine who's supposed to get it?
Yeah, I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago is a good idea.
HR 40 is, we're pushing very hard. There's been a lot of debate and discussion about the bill.
This is a proposal for reparations for the institution of slavery.
Yes.
The institution of slavery has never gone away.
Convict leasing, the oppression of voting, poll taxes, and racist GI bills.
HR 40 is, in fact, the response of the United States of America long overdue.
I get this call from a dear friend. He said, man, you know, we got a bad sister in Evanston, and she's pushing the reparations question strong.
Redress for the black community, for the nation.
And so it was Alderman Simmons. You have become the visible face and the driving force of the Evanston Reparation Initiative.
Some mornings I wake up and I feel like, wow, I'm a part of history. This is special. And then it's intimidating at the same time, because what if you don't get it right?
The greatest hurdle is the political will to make it happen, and Alderman Simmons made it happen, gathering a lot of evidence, specifically implicating actions of the city.
This program, as it is incomplete.
I don't know why they would be given more status than any other group of people.
People have been extremely nasty to me.
You don't give them money and then tell them what they can do with it.
You cannot pay my grandfather back. He's dead. Give us what we're due.
I don't think it's going to go too far or anywhere.
I'm still not prepared to join an insurrection. I just want you to understand who we are.
We in Evanston are leading the way to heal a nation.
We don't want a piece of freedom. We want the whole package, and that's reparations.
Perfect. Gonna get
if you're
out
a professional
there,
woman whose career is not this? Thriving.
Perfect. So you can see the work is complicated, right? And our harm is so deep and heavy. It's hard to feel satisfied. And how will we be satisfied? But today I'm going to speak from the perspective of being a stakeholder. Who here is a San Francisco stakeholder? Stakeholder. Stakeholder. You are black. You are from this city. You want reparations. You want repair. You want empowerment. You want liberation. You are standing on that. So doesn't mean you have any particular title anywhere or any institution. Now, some of you may also have a title. Are there institutional leaders here as well? So there's some overlap, which is great. So that's what you and I have in common. And so I came to this work as a Evanston stakeholder, the historically black community in Evanston, but I was an elected official at the time. And I came to be an elected official because I was a stakeholder, and I saw that we were not being included. We were not enjoying the same livability as everybody else in town. We did not have access to anything that we needed that was being celebrated. And that led me into pursuing elected office. Did that and saw that all of these conditions we have are policy conditions, and that we can change them with legislation. And as home rule municipalities, we have the authority to do so. And so I want to just start with that as context of where I come to you as a practitioner, not as an academic, and there's other types of leaders in the space, attorneys, and but I'm coming to you as your peer, as a stakeholder and a practitioner, just like you are. Additionally, my work is now informed by many touches with foundations, organizations, now dozens of them, that I've been able to talk to on their history of harm and also their goals for repair. In addition to foundations and other institutions, many colleges and universities, just returning last week from speaking in the UK at the University of Cambridge, as they just sent their acknowledgement of their history of slavery as well. In addition to that, my work now has reached global communities, also having been to Accra, Ghana, going to Cape Town to learn more about truth and reconciliation, going to Guinea-Bissau, West Africa, after doing DNA and genealogy work and finding out that my foremother was kidnapped from Guinea-Bissau, and so going and returning there last year so that I could connect with my ancestral home, and then also recently going to Vatican City, Rome, where we have been able to bring a case, a presentment for reparations to the Vatican for their atrocities against black people and really initiating in some way the transatlantic slave trade. And so what I've learned in this experience is how connected all of it is, but how important the hyper-local work that we're doing is impacting global repair. And so although we are concerned about our neighborhoods, in my case, I was concerned about a four-block radius where all black folks were forced to live at one point in time. And now the work is not only impacting other cities to be inspired, but it's now impacting other nations to be inspired, having met city council leaders in the UK last week that are replicating the things that we're doing here in the United States. And then this is just a map that shows some of the cities in which I've been able to serve at First Repair. So quickly, there are so many ways that we think about reparations, and usually we hear people discuss a check or some sort of form of compensation. But we look at a very comprehensive approach to reparations, the process of repairing, healing, and restoring a people who were injured due to their group identity in violation of their fundamental human rights by a government, corporation, institution, or individual. And that definition is in COBRA's definition, which is the oldest 35-year-old organization that has been fighting for reparations. We're also looking at all forms of reparations. And so although there is a very active group for cash payments, when we go into every city, and when I say we, I'm speaking about my colleagues at Redress Network, every city we go in, the prescription for reparations from black community is broad. Black folks want full repair. Black folks want a remedy, a portfolio of remedies that include cash but also include access to education and health and housing and business and wellness and so on. And so we embrace the forms of reparations that are in this slide, and I would be happy to share this slide with anyone that's interested. And then additionally, we're looking at all institutions. So although the city of San Francisco is responsible to repair its harms in the black community, so are the universities in town, the healthcare systems, the public school systems, foundations, businesses, possibly some independent families in town have harmed black community here in San Francisco. I don't know the full history, but I'm telling you the story is the same in every city that we have been in. And so we are holding institutions accountable in the space that we're in. And so in my case, I was an elected official. I knew that I had to do whatever I could do to the fullest authority of my role as a city councilwoman in a home rule municipality to bring repair. And so cities across the United States now are looking at local reparations. And before, we were all really fighting for H.R. 40. It was introduced in 1989, has been ceremonially reintroduced every Congress since 1989. Historically, it passed out of committee for the first time last year, but still, we have no H.R. 40 commission, and so we're doing what we can within our purview. The city of Evanston is looking at our zoning laws and our housing discriminations that were anti-black, responsible for the current segregation that we have today. Other cities like Amherst, Massachusetts, is looking at their racial covenants. Tulsa, Oklahoma, of course, and very appropriately, are looking to repair the massacre, the race massacre of 1921. I'm sorry, I visited there and I get emotional every time I think about what happened there. So in Evanston, this is a city map of our historically redlined community. Sure, it's the same here. Although this has been outlawed with fair housing when that was passed in 1968, today this red map, I live in the center of it, is where black community still lives. It's also where black community does not have a neighborhood school. The only city, the only neighborhood in all of Evanston that doesn't have a neighborhood school. The only neighborhood that doesn't have access to healthy food, a food desert. The only neighborhood with air quality issues because of busing, because we don't have a school. We have less community amenities, less environmental assets, deteriorating built environment, and so on and so on in Evanston. And so these are some of the things that brought me to call the question of reparations in our city. In Evanston, we have an income gap of $50,000 between black and white Evanston. Here is a list of recommendations that were given from black Evanstonians in our work in 2019 when we began our community work to hear from the community on what forms of reparations do we want to see. And you could see that it's a long list. This is a very limited list, but I want to say that it's been the same in every city. And so I won't go through this whole timeline because this is really a two-hour presentation and I have 10 minutes, but our process for reparations, although the introduction was made in 2019, I really look at 2002 as when we began our commitment to reparations. Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste, he was then an alderman in Evanston, or councilman in Evanston, he returned, like many others, from the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, and many local leaders began introducing resolutions for reparations. Now, at this point, it was just to support H.R. 40. It didn't have accountability to the city. It didn't have a budget, but it was a commitment to repair. In addition, there were slavery disclosure laws that were passed as well. But through a couple years of work, community process, town hall meetings, stakeholder meetings, committee meetings, city council meetings, we passed Resolution 126R19. That established our reparations committee. It committed our first $10 million of cannabis sales tax to reparations, and then it prioritized our goals for reparations based on the feedback we had from the community, which was housing, economic development, and educational initiatives. So more about process, and I'll say that at this point we're dispersing reparations. So we've went through a community process, identify eligibility, identify our first recipients, and have begun dispersing reparations. Now this is a part that's really, really important. Stakeholders, legal professionals, government, historians, financial institutions, allies, funding sources, researchers, philanthropists, everyone in community is responsible to the reparations process, not just black folks in us identifying the harm and prescribing the remedy, but our allies in doing the work, supporting it, funding it, holding themselves accountable, educating their own communities. And so this map, you probably saw it yesterday when the Redress Network presented, but I love to share it because it shows how so many cities, including San Francisco, are beginning to take their steps towards reparations. And here it shows how reparations is being categorized. And so lastly, I just want to say that what we're doing, San Francisco, Evanston, Detroit, Michigan, Amherst, Massachusetts, is having global reach. And so although we're here right now in San Francisco, communities across this world, including Europe and West Africa, which have been only in the last 60 days, know about the work that's happening here and holding their own governments accountable and being inspired about how we might be repaired as a global black community. And so my message really is that if we synchronize our local efforts, if we support one another, if we add on to best practices from city to city, we will get to global repair for Black folks. And so with that, I just want to introduce my colleagues. I don't know, raise your hand, which is coming first, and I'll introduce you.
Actually, you want to open up questions for you first.
Oh, okay.
Everybody saw us yesterday.
Oh. Okay. Okay. So I just kind of breezed through that to make sure we had space for everyone, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Yes.
I just had a question about the term stakeholder, and is that a fixed definition, or is it in any way subjective?
I consider it fixed, and, you know, my colleagues will respond to it, but it is one that has been without debate in the movement for reparations. Stakeholders being those that are directly harmed or harmed through lineage. So although I wasn't in Evanston during our period of harm, which is 1919 to 1969 is when we had anti-Black laws, I'm a stakeholder because I'm a direct descendant of six generations of my family that lived in Evanston. And so it's not a term that there's a lot of things we debate in the movement. That's not been one of them.
I want to be clear about why I'm asking. I'm a homeowner in Oakland, but I feel like I'm a stakeholder in San Francisco because everything they do to San Francisco, they then do it to Oakland. So I'm like, it's just rolling right down the hill. Let me just get over here first to support what's happening over here.
Yeah.
But so that was more of like, just like an intro question. Yeah. It's not about how you define it with the whole movement. Just in the room when you said raise your hand if you're a stakeholder, one of the reasons I'm
Everybody Black is a stakeholder. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you may not share a zip code as, you know, my brother here, but you're fighting for the same cause and you've had the same harm. So you may not be eligible for reparations here in San Francisco, but you are eligible for reparations.
Right.
So.
Poor people get things.
Yes, you should. Yes, you should. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And the work that you're doing nationally. My question to you is, how do we develop a framework for institutions that may want to take an internal look on how they can identify harm and identify reparations for harm they've done? What if there's a business or a corporation that says, you know, we know this is more focused on institutions or government, but what models can we use to identify the harm that we've done? Offer a series of reparations to our communities. A lot of these corporations, they'll move into these cities, and the institutions who we're asking for reparations from will give them the tax breaks and the tax cuts.
That's right.
Thus, they become part of that arm, too, from our community, and then want to just send some volunteers to go pick some dirt. We Black Lives Matter, see? So Black Lives Matter, but all right, what's your reparations?
That's right. Love the question, and you're spot on. And the framework really starts with the case for reparations. And so each institution, organization, whoever it is, government, has to have a harm report. Some communities call it a harm report, but they have to do their own history, uncomfortable history. And so at Cambridge, there was just a debate that I think is worth exploring more, that institutions don't do their own harm report. For obvious reasons, right? But what's been happening now is you have to start with a case specific to that institution. So you can't satisfy the goals of H.R. 40, which are slavery reparations and the transatlantic slave trade, but you can do what's happened in San Francisco. And so once you establish that, whether the institution does it or someone else, in our case, we had a local historian, Dino Robinson, who's been archiving Black history for about 25 years. And so that accelerated our process in getting our report. From the report, we uncovered that there were zoning and housing laws that were anti-Black, and some cases were so extreme that Black family homes were physically picked up and moved to a less valuable part of town because they didn't want us to have access to our lakefront and the value of that. And so once we had that, we were able to identify a harm and then narrowly tailor remedies in direct correlation to that harm. And so that's how we came up with housing as a first priority. But we're still working to uncover more. And unfortunately, we know there's not going to be any shortage of harms.
So you guys got an
internal historian? A community historian. Yeah. So my first request went to our clerk's office, and I got a very surface kind of general, no specificity that allowed me to take it to a redress network and do something. But the historian gave us the real. Yes.
And basically, the coalition is.
Can you hear me? Okay. Basically, the coalition is a coalition of Black-led individuals and/or organizations that are working on reparations or redress at the local level. And then alliances who came in, and so maybe those are institutions or organizations, and then allies, so non-Black POC or white institutions. And one of the most interesting things that came out of that was actually the Virginia League of Women Voters. And so I'm going to just raise this case up because I think it's really interesting. So the first thing they did is they examined their own history of discrimination and harm. And they wrote a really comprehensive report on the role that the Virginia League of Women Voters played in continuing oppression, plunder, economic genocide, right? And they developed this report, and then they educated themselves on reparations. So they would come to the coalition meetings, and they would hear about the efforts that were happening around the Commonwealth of Virginia, and talk to communities that were leading redress at the local level. And now they're in the process of developing reparations, right? So they took a really hard look at themselves. It was like, we have done a lot of harm. And not only have we acknowledged that, but we've now put it into publication that we are responsible and we have accountability, and then educated themselves on reparations and specifically are responding to the Black-led efforts so that the reparations are being led by the Black-led organizations in the ways in which they'll input either money or resources or whatever they have. So I think that for an institution is similar to what's happened at the city, but also a way that institutions can take a real role in this space.
I want to add something to that is what's important. You could probably keep that because is that I'm glad Linda got to the point where she said they were listening to the Black community as they were prescribing remedy, because had they decided on their harm and prescribed their remedy, and what that would have been a problem, right? So you want to make sure that the community is engaged at the point of, really, I think, at the point of uncovering the harm, but definitely at the point of prescribing remedy. In the orange shirt, yes.
Oscar James.
Mm-hmm.
I have two things I want to say. One, New York and San Francisco Stock Exchange is a problem that has stopped Black folks from benefiting economically. But in San Francisco, for an example, a lot of San Francisco was redlined.
Mm-hmm.
And the only two places that we could live is Bayview Hunters Point and also the Western Addition. Western Addition and the Barbary Close, mm-hmm, were the two basic places that Black folks lived, mm-hmm, back in the 1800s and what have you. A lot of people think we came here in the 40s and what have you. We've been here since the Spanish American, with Alexander Leostorff, who was Black in this city.
Mm-hmm.
But my whole thing is this. When Willie Mays first came here to San Francisco, he tried to buy a house up in Forest Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And they denied him buying a home up in Forest Hills. He had to stay with Mary Shelley at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
In 54, 55, when they were building Westlake with government monies, okay, my mother tried to move out because there was a lot of black people moving into Hunters Point. My mother was one way and my father was another way. She didn't want to live with a whole bunch of black folks, so she wanted to move in Westlake. We went to Westlake. They told her there that they didn't allow black folks out there then. That was mm-hmm. another red line. Not until 1955, 56, they allowed black folks to move into Lakeview, Ocean View. There was no blacks. There was a thing out there where they were denied. Now, all this is in black and white,
mm-hmm.
where they can go and tell you what you can and cannot do. A lot of it is being changed now, but we still have places in San Francisco that black folks and third world people cannot live.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I want to say.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, my name is Hatim, and my question is about the in a world where we do get reparations, how do we ensure that that's not it, that we're not forgotten, and the fact that how I feel like Native Americans are forgotten after they got reparations, and how like people would like to say that racism was over when Obama got elected, mm-hmm. like, oh, we got reparations? Oh, y'all got no more problems now. You good. We can ignore you now.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we build that narrative or ensure that that reality, you know, it doesn't go that line, that road where as soon as we get reparations, that's not the end all. That was time. That's not the end all be all of, you know, of our strife and our struggle. We make sure that, yeah, we get reparations, but if we see some problems, we still, you know, going after them.
That's
and that
right.
We've seen.
That's right. So two things. One, that was really scary because I never heard a plane that close. I didn't know if that's the norm around. Okay. 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 Perfect. Right. Right, and then to the point that brother, did you say Oscar? Yeah, in keeping our history, whether it's through oral history or you know, black history museums and archives and things, we have to keep that alive. And then I think we have to maintain our hope. I know one of the speakers earlier talked about hope. I think it was Dr. K maybe. And so once we get a milestone, we have to know we build on that milestone and that we have to continue. So like in Evanston, that milestone is fine, but we have to continue building and building and building. And so I think that part is on us, that we don't allow institutions to feel like they have accomplished something by sometimes apologies and resolutions without impact. So I think that part is on us to stay organized and united amongst ourselves. That's one thing we could all do better, is be united within our own communities so that we can keep the demand for reparations alive. I think here first before we go, you had a question?
No.
Oh, there was, okay. Yes, here, yes. Mm-hmm.
Just for clarity, you might get some of the folks who are watching the live stream here.
Okay.
So there's a proverb, and the proverb says, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but when desires are met, it leads to a tree that's fruitful and full of life. And so we're going after so many things, affordable housing, education, medical, all of these things that we need, and we still have to ask the same way. What I saw yesterday when our budgeting leaders were there, and the names escape me. Yes, okay. How excited he got when Diane from 100% College Prep said 100 of my students successfully, and they did this, they did that, and I'm so glad I gave them money, and what else do you need? Our problem, too, today is we go after these things, but we're still not fighting for the root cause, and American history. American history excludes all of the contributions when you really want to talk about what we've done to make life better, easier, and more comfortable, and to advance science and technology, it's excluded from the history books. But when you add that and fight that they put this in the history books, that it goes to the corporate field, it goes to the social field and industry as well, I believe and I know from the reaction of everything that we do that looks so successful, and the Dr. Sy's, Dr. Davis's, and yourself, you get the yes. We need to push that they allow American history into the schools, into the narrative when we talk about how Neil Armstrong landed on the moon but failed to say how he got to the moon and back home safely. We don't push for those things, and therefore the next thing we need, well, what is it on this list? So you have to go through that list carefully and jump through hoops each time. But we need to look at root causes for all of these symptoms that we're solving. And work with those root causes, because globally, the African American nation is viewed as a people that don't contribute to the world and society around them only because they don't know their American history. So we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility. And if we would think that as well as all the other wonderful things we're doing, we're going to get much further, much faster, and with less of a hardship, losing so many of us along the way. This out-migration is taking us out. Many of us won't be here too much longer. And you're going to lose history when Oscar James, myself, and others that are up there in age, when we disappear. And you need that history. You need to understand it, and we need to be able to move with what we do because of it.
That's right. I hope everyone took notes on that. Yes, thank you for that.
I'm going to piggyback on that right now.
Yes.
I hope each and every one of you become members of the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society.
Yes.
We are archiving our history, and I'm a board member, okay? So definitely.
Can you share the website for those that are watching online?
It's sfaahcs.org, San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society.
Awesome. And we had a question right here.
It's on 762 Fulton in the Western Edition.
Thank you very much. So one thing that really resonated with me in watching the film or the, you know, the clip that you showed is the sentiment of this is, you know, you're like honored to do this work, but also there's the burden of what if we don't get it right. And I have the immense professional privilege and honor of my entire career to be working alongside the San Francisco African American Reparations Committee and on behalf of the HRC. Applause for the committee members because they've been doing great work. So I am wondering, we know that Black San Franciscans deserve billions of dollars. We know this. It's been written many times. There's like three reports that have been done in 50 years that say the same thing, you know. That's the case in a lot of American cities when we study Black communities. We know what we owe. We've said it many times, and we haven't kept the promise. And so what I'm wondering is how do we, there's this question of political will, and how do we, that is sort of the elephant in the room that, you know, even though we create these documents that have these recommendations, the next step after that is to push through political will and make it actually happen. And I do have those concerns, like, and you maybe can hear it in my voice, like, I want this to succeed beyond our wildest dreams, but the reality is that the political will sometimes ebbs and flows. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that and how to really push through to get what we deserve and what we're owed, or what, you know, Black San Francisco is owed, without selling us short or having this, you know, having someone say, give us something less than we deserve, and say, okay, well, reparations is done. Let's move on to the next thing. So, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I do. Do you want to answer it? So the point when I said, you know, what if we get it right? You know, a lot of the filming for this happened in 2019 and 2020, and we grow every day. And one of my mentors has helped me understand that, you know, this is our leg of the race. You know, we are building on the work of the elders and our ancestors that have been doing the work. So any steps that we make is good. So I don't want anyone else to use that as an example to beat yourself up or feel like you've not contributed enough. Just waking up Black and surviving sometimes is enough in America, right? So I've grown a lot since then, but the political will is everything. And so that's why, for me, I had a short window of time before I left office, knowing that when I transition out, the same sort of fire, you know, would likely not be there to carry it on. And so we have to make sure that, you know, we're feeling empowered, that we keep the mess all about narrative. More narrative work needs to happen. And so narrative change is becoming a topic of every discussion in racial redress, as it should be. And so political will changes, elected leaders change. You know, even right now we're looking at, you know, the hope for H.R. 40 to pass, and now the discussion is how it might interfere with midterm elections and this and that. And so we know that there's always going to be sort of that political culture and climate that will keep us further away from our goals. But we have to know that we're building on what Callie House did and what Queen Mother Moore did and, you know, the message of King and Malcolm and so on, and know that we can't tire from that, and also know that it's a continuum, like our work is cumulative, and then just wake up and also be well. And so I hope Billy, she's our wellness person in the movement, talks more about how we better balance things, because I was not well. I was very unhealthy, just working every day, and I realized, like, I can't solve our, you know, race crisis, right, like me. And in the interim, I'm going to kill myself, and I have children and parents to take care of. And so I think that we just we love ourselves and we trust ourselves. We stay committed to the work. We work together because none of us is as smart as all of us, right? And then we be well. And I'm going to let Billy make sure that she talks to us about being well as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can everybody just give Robin a round of applause? I'm always so grateful and blessed to be in space with her. We were actually hoping that this session would be more of a conversation. We were hoping that you guys could engage with us. We were hoping that you guys would be able to, and I wanted to uplift some of the people who are in the room. I wanted to make sure that we acknowledge that there are people who are doing this work in their work lives in this space with us. This gathering that you guys are having, like, for this session, is creating an opportunity, and you are the chosen ones in this moment for the work that you are doing. Like, I just have to acknowledge who you are in this space, and even if you're doing camera, and even if you are being a support person and don't view yourself as an ally in the space, or you don't realize that you're here for a real reason, I need you to know that it wasn't by accident that we're together in this particular moment, and that we are here now. A beautiful congresswoman said, our existence is our resistance. Like, us unapologetically entering into the room is what we are offering, and that is a lot. Like, you are here, and we appreciate you for everything that you're doing and the fact that you survived to be able to get here. And on top of that, your ancestors and everything that they did for you to have been here right now in this moment is valued and appreciated and acknowledged, period. Like, I just have to remind us that this ain't by accident. Like, we are here. Yes. Like, I'm not playing for y'all. Okay, so I think I met everybody yesterday. My sister is here with us today, and she told me that I didn't tell you guys anything about me. Like, I didn't do an intro. I am a stakeholder. I am a member of the community. I am a descendant. I was born in Africa because my parents got fed up with the United States, and they left and tried to repatriate semi-unsuccessfully because they came back, and I grew up in the D.C. area. But the time that my family spent in Africa shaped our worldview in ways that helped me to see something that is robbed from black children from the time they come out of, like, come into life and look at a white doctor delivering them. Like, something happens in that space where you're institutionalized from the moment of birth. Something happens in that space when you are institutionalized in the way that you perceive growth. Like, you have to go to school to be able to validly grow and experience life. And so this conference had me shook a little bit. Like, I appreciate you guys because you raised some incredible questions yesterday. And I am more than sick and tired of having conversations about conversations. And I just need for us to recognize that the format that we are able to do things in is not really conducive to the long-term work that we're trying to do. And so because we have a two-hour time slot together in this beautiful space when they're having an air show, then I want to remind you guys that the work that we're doing in this is a moment for us to come together and then go forward and do the work together. Like, this is not something that you just, we're not consuming this like a television show. Like, we're here to be able to do this work together and get this work done in ourselves, in our families, in our communities, in our nation, and in the world. And that's the way that I engage the work. So I wanted to share a little bit because they said I'd have 10 minutes to talk. And so I said, well, one, I want to bring you guys into that conversation. Like, each of you, I want for us to do some things together and workshop a little bit. Maybe even if we have 10 more minutes to just break up into some small groups and, like, have some deeper conversations. But I also wanted to take a moment and recall some of their very important points that were raised. And John, from both sides of the conversation, I want him to be a part of a group that leads the conversation that talks very specifically about, well, my sister called it the case for evidence. Like, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning processing for you, for which I was talking about yesterday, and the question was raised. So Linda Mann, as you guys know, is my colleague in this space, and I am unapologetically me. This is how I am. This is how I continue to be. So this is it. This is how I am. So one of the questions, or the question that John raised yesterday, was about why do we need someone like Linda to be in this space with us? Like, why can't we just do it for ourselves? Why can't we just go and collect the check? Why can't we just, how come it's not just coming to us when they know what they did? Like, they know what they did, and it was done, and we all know it. Like, we don't have to pretend like it didn't happen. Like, the harm happened. the harm happened, and it's really clear and obvious. And I used to use the example of like a person who's – I have a friend whose baby was born in a cab. And because the baby was born in a cab, then the hospital couldn't certify the birth. But the baby was there. And the baby was, you know, like they did the work after the baby came, but they couldn't do the paperwork to be able to get the child the documentation that they existed. And I think Black San Francisco has an issue with being denied their existence. Like, people will say, who is, like, what, Black San Francisco? That was a long time ago. Like, what are you talking about? Like, San Francisco doesn't have a reparations story because there was no slavery in San Francisco. You know, like, what is that? And so you guys have some incredible historians, and I think that your question was really perfect about the harm report. I am getting off on a tangent. All right. There's the harm report, and there is that piece, and that's what I asked for. I said, okay, I'm going to go to a city. I'm going to talk to the city. Where's the harm report? And what they sent me is the names of about a dozen historians, but they didn't send me the harm report. So that's work that needs to be done, and I need for everybody who's interested in that to join the Historic Preservation Society that she stepped out, join that, talked to Dr. Carolyn Scott, and talked to Oscar James. And right, evidence. So I'm a lawyer, you know that. So when you, okay, the reason why you need a harm report, the reason why you need to present that there is because you have to be able to prove and demonstrate that, first of all, you exist. So we have a community in Virginia, Brown Girl community in Virginia, and the first thing that they told them is that they don't exist. And so we came in, we said, we know you exist, and here's the way to document that you exist. Put these pieces of paper forward so that the government can give you the certification, i.e. birth certificate, that you are here and you exist. So once you've got the – it is a lot of unnecessary – I don't know. It's a lot that you have to jump through. But the point is you want to be able to present that evidence. You want to be able to present that documentation. You don't want to go into it without knowing what documents count and what documents don't count. Like, you know, I've got the umbilical cord. Does that count? No. The umbilical cord is not evidence that counts. So if you guys are interested in that particular conversation, then I want to break up into a smaller group and have that conversation about the existence, the evidence, the case, like why you need people who understand how to jump through hoops to be able, or what a hoop looks like, so that you can go through those processes to be able to get into those positions. Like, that's a real conversation. The other group that I'd like for us to break up into is the coalition question. So, like, there was a person yesterday who asked a question about what do I do as an ally? What do I do in this space? How do I support this without, you know, how do I not step on people's toes? How come we don't follow the example of the Japanese and just do what they did? And it's such a beautiful question, because what I know is that the Japanese modeled us and they got it. So if y'all want to have that conversation, let's break up in a real quick group and do that. And then the third conversation is it's about the money flow. So, like, checks get disseminated, and money is flowing, and why is the money flowing this way and not flowing that way? Like, how come, like, how does the money flow? How do we need the money to flow? Is that a conversation? Yeah. All right. So we've got, 10 minutes?
What time is this program? 3:30.
Okay, so we're good. Okay, we're good. So we got Yeah. I want you in a conversation. This is brilliant right here. All right, so I'll just do like 5 minutes of questions real quick in a group, and then we can kind of, and if you guys want to do it a different way, we can kind of do that. But I just wanted it to be your moment, and I want you guys to get what you came to get out of this, because we didn't fly all the way out here to hear ourselves talk about what we always talk about. Like, we came here to let get you guys where you want to be. Does that make sense? Okay, go ahead. That was you. Oh, okay. I saw you raise your hand, and that's the reason why I wanted to answer the questions before we go into conversation.
Thank you. Don't want to lose the point about rest as a form of resistance.
Oh,
and
right.
So
that's
I'm
right. She
really
told me I'm
hoping
supposed to do wellness.
That we talk about that self-care.
Yes.
Because I asked Sister Robin this in Chicago. Yes. I want to know because we
yes.
still sick and tired of being sick and tired. Thank you, Sandy.
Yes. Yes. Okay, let me get the other questions, too.
Maybe that's a group.
Oh, the wellness group? No, I'm going to answer the wellness question first. I'm going to talk about wellness. So anytime I do any event, and they all know this, that in the planning of that event, we have at least one person who's in the room that's concentrated on wellness, and it's a triggering topic, and it's like trauma-inducing, and re-traumatizing, and the people who get the best funding for it, like, really, really want you to keep telling your trauma story, like, again and again, like, show us the scars, you know, like, how many times did they take your house, and how, well, look, you're homeless, oh, that's so good, tell us about how, what was that like, what was it like when you were sleeping on the, oh, but were you sleeping on the park bench? Oh, but that's not really homeless. You were sleeping in your car? Oh, no, wait a second. So you were sleeping on the couch? Okay, yeah, that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So I am a pure advocate of wellness in process. And the phrase that I use when we're planning and thinking and working together is, what do I say? How you do what you do is just as important as what you do. And the reparations work should be reparatory. Like, if you're doing reparatory justice and you are a stakeholder in this space, then you should absolutely be getting beautiful things that happen as a result of the work that you're doing. And I'm going to speak on a slightly controversial conversation topic. And that's Patrice Cullors. This morning, I was very early in the morning. I went to my sister goes swimming all the time to for her sanity, and so she took me to her pool, and I said, okay, well, if there's amenities, I can deal with that because I'm not going swimming because my edges. But we went to a hot tub, and it's cold outside. It's like 70, 60-something degrees in the morning, and it was lovely. And there were all of these wealthy older folks in Santa Cruz, because I was in Santa Cruz. And I went to the sauna, and I went to the hot tub, and I went to the and I did go out dancing last night. And we did deal with a lot of real-life things as well. There's a young man who was arrested this morning, and she's the head of security in her community, and so we were dealing with that, and I was also preparing for this conversation with you guys and processing a lot of, like, I'm very emotional, and so I was, like, dealing with everything that you guys were saying yesterday and wanting so much to be able to help you with what you're doing. So Patrice Cullors was really harshly criticized for the home that she created for activists in the space, that she wanted to create a place where people could go and not be stressed, not have to worry about housing, not have to worry about, like, they could be activists and artists and creatives in the space where they could go outside and go into a hot tub and go into a steam room and not be stressed. And I don't think that only rich old white people should have access to not being stressed. And the conditions that we created in this cultural kind of space is that we have to work all the time and we don't deserve to take a break. And when we do, we're, like, not really respected for it. And so I was having this beautiful conversation with John about walking the walk and doing this work, and how you do what you do is just as important as what you do. And I do get a little bit of pushback from my supervisor at work when I'm planning on doing things that are pure joy, because I like doing reparations work that is pure joy for Black people. Because what did my ancestors struggle for if I can't enjoy being here with you right now? Like, if we can't have a beautiful lunch at the pier, whatever that thing was called that we just now went to, then why are we doing this work? Why are we struggling? Why can't we enjoy life? Like, we should be able to find joy. We should be able to do that. And we should be able to redress the harms that have been done. But we don't always have to be in trauma for us to be able to be redressing our harms. We should be able to do health and wealth and healing. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So,
okay, everybody, big round of applause for San Francisco. Reparations now.